Now, I'm told that my next guest is not a massive fan of the limelight, preferring to let her work do the talking. And it's understandable why that might be the case when you look at the catalogue and the calibre of work that Cape Town's own Amy Jeffter has been producing in the last few years. She's an award-winning playwright, screenwriter and director, and has been involved in some of the most powerful and important work on both stage and screen to come out of South Africa in recent times. She wrote the screenplay for the highly acclaimed movie Ellen, the Ellen Pakkie story. Her directorial film debut Barakat won the award for Best Narrative at the 23rd Real Sisters of the Diaspora Festival in the US. She's also been signed on to adapt a Booker Prize shortlisted novel for the screen, and she's one half of the team behind the Cape Flats neo-noir murder mystery Skimmer Dance, currently streaming on Showmax. Before we meet her, let's take a listen to some of her most acclaimed work.
The man Glenn Fortune has many sides. Friend, mentor and icon.
Say thank you and my family. Your Oasis is with yellow gebouw.
The whole nightclub industry is taking a hit. It's evaporating. And if you look closely at the world that's coming up, we own most of that.
Your Oasis is here for sale.
Weet you how many backroom casinos operate right over the Cape? It's a multi-million rand revenue stream.
I'm going to bullets for your fight, as you're not eerlijk.
This is about paying off debt and you can stop your operations immediately.
But what is she going to look
for? The money that she has promised.
Jane Vita RMC has a reputation. They are not our type of people.
So by your secrets hier.
Mense kry 'n manier om dit uit te blou.
Mense praat altyd asof hulle my storie ken. Al wat hulle weet is ek het 'n moord gepleeg.
Today we mourn with the Pakkies family the loss of their son, Adam Pakkies.
Asseblief vergeef my.
Vermoord.
Die Here sal ons nie dit dra.
Vir ons, die is jou dad.
Your Worship, Advocate Adrian Samuels, I'm considering representing the accused.
This text will make an example out of you. You're looking at 20 years. I can win this case, but you have to trust me.
Ongelukkig het AB al sy kans gekry.
Ons gaan deur 'n slegte tyd by die huis. Gee hom nog net een kans asseblief, mevrou.
Mamy, jong mense soos AB word deur hierdie plek ingesleek.
Ek dink ek het 'n jobie vir jou. Jy drop iets hierso af en tel sy iets daar op maklik, man.
Okay, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Amy Jeffter to Weekend Breakfast. Amy, great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah Jane.
When you listen to that, how do are you? Is there a sense of pride? Is there a sense of what is there a feeling of?
I mean, the first thing I'm like, that's a lot of pages. That's a lot of pages of writing. I haven't sat and counted how many pages I've written in my career, but I would say it's well into over a few thousand.
Sure.
So yeah, all I hear when I hear dialogue is I see pages and pages in front of me. Also, I mean, a sense of appreciation, of course, that I get to do that for a living.
Yeah, for sure. I'm absolutely fascinated to know from you, growing up, which were the movies, the TV shows, the stories that moved you?
I mean, I grew up on like a diet of, I think, Roald Dahl books. Fantastic Five, like I loved reading Judy Blume, I loved reading Sweet Valley High. I guess the stuff that girls and young kids are into, like I like reading adventure novels, Goosebumps, you know, horror books, like these were all my kind of childhood staples. I started reading Lady Bird books when I was like 3 years old. I couldn't read, but I memorized from listening to the tape, and then I would just repeat the words and pretend I was reading because I wanted to be able to read so badly. And I guess, yeah, that was kind of my childhood staple. And I would read the newspaper a lot. You know, my parents had a newspaper subscription and we'd get all the daily papers every day delivered to our house. And so I would sit and read that at the dining room table. And it was really very varied. And I guess, yeah, I grew up also just watching cartoons. I didn't spend a lot of time in front of the television. But when I did, it was cartoons, mostly sitcoms of the 90s. So pretty much what everyone was watching, I guess.
Yeah, because as you're sort of naming these, the Sweet Valley High, I'd completely forgotten about those crazy blonde twins. As you're reeling off, and the Lady Bird books, and I'm nodding, saying yep, and sitting down at the kitchen table with the newspaper, which is exactly what I used to do. And I guess it's a sort of a people of our generation. I think I might be being a little ambitious that we are in the same generation, but you know, give or take 10 years, that the things that we were considering consuming at the time, and also the appetite. What I'm hearing is your appetite for stories and for
yeah.
Was there one thing in particular? Was there a particular story that made you realize the power of storytelling?
I think not one in particular, but I do remember reading a book of market theatre plays, a collection of market theatre plays from like the 80s. It was like a collection of protest plays, actually. And up until then, I hadn't picked up a play. I hadn't read a play in my life. I didn't know what it looked like on the page. But I think it was in grade 9 or maybe in grade 10 that I found this collection in the library. And I just like went through it so quickly, and I kept rereading and rereading it. And it was really like that was my introduction to theater, and that was my introduction to the form of storytelling in, I guess, in a theatrical medium. And it's kind of where I was decided I want to do this thing. I want to write stories in this way. I'd never seen a play on the page before.
What was the first play that you saw in a theater?
I think it was. I'm trying to think now. There was a version of Antigone that they did at the Baxter. I want to say it's Sylvain Strike. And they did a reworking of a Greek tragedy. And I can't get to the name now. Jocasta Rising. That was the name of the play. Jocasta Rising, which was the first play I saw at the Baxter. The first real play, I would say. Before then, I'd been exposed to a lot of children's theatre. So my parents would take me on a Saturday morning to the Baxter foyer where they would do Noddy and the kids' theatre stuff. But that was the first time I went into a big theatre, into a real theatre. I remember watching that. I remember watching Poison and Cat and the Kings, the early David Carmichael Peterson musicals. And those were really my introduction to theatre.
I love speaking to storytellers and hearing them speak about their early years and their early memories of theatres. And in a Cape Town context, so often it's the Baxter and the role that the Baxter has played in in shaping the love of storytelling for so many people. Juanita Adams was our guest in this segment last week, and we were speaking about the Baxter and about the term storytelling, because you come with a number of different titles, as I think you're a writer, a playwright, a screenwriter, a director, all of these things, but ultimately they all fall under the umbrella of storyteller, which for me is such a powerful term. And I think particularly for us as women, for us as women of color, also as storytellers, it speaks to giving voice, the telling of and the agency that comes with that, and the power that comes with being able to tell our own stories.
Absolutely. And I think, I often refer to storytelling as alchemy, because you don't know where those ingredients come from. I think being a storyteller is something that is in your bones and in your DNA that you can't ever quite, you don't understand where those inspirations come from. It's like you saying about learning about your younger days. It's like these seeds are planted subconsciously, and then they manifest in the stories that you choose to tell. And there's a kind of alchemy to how that happens. Like I don't control it. I don't necessarily choose consciously what the themes are that come through in my work. I don't try to analyze the stories I'm telling. But when I look at my work over like a long period, like when you play those clips, then I can kind of see, okay, there's a thread there. There's something thematic. There's something that drives my need to tell not the same type of story over and over, but the bones are almost always the same thing.
We are often told, aren't we, as writers, as authors, as storytellers, to write what we know. But you've admitted that actually when you started out as a playwright, you pushed back against writing about your community. And why did you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of preconditioning. Like I said, like even when I mentioned the books and things I was reading at a young age, I never saw myself represented in those stories. Yeah. Like you said, it's like Sweet Valley High is like white blonde American twins. Enid Blyton is the five little white kids running around having adventures. I never saw me in those stories.
Yeah.
So I often thought that in order to have a story that is accepted and loved and read by children, it needs to be from a certain perspective. Like you can't write stories about little black girls. You can't write stories about families who live on the Cape Flats. You can't write stories about people who sound like me. And so I think my early years trying to find my voice was about erasing that identity, or at least neutralizing it. And I think what I realized the more the older I got, and that's obviously the beauty of age, is that like you start to realize that your voice is in your specificity, and my stories were in my unique perspective. And I started to realize that the more I went international and the broader my work became, that people were interested in the very tiny details of the stories I told. It was, you know, a story about a family in Athlone. It was a story about a Muslim mother on the Cape Flats. It was a story of a very particular part of Lavender Hill. People were interested in that, and there was no need for me to kind of pull back on leaning into what made my voice very specific to my context.
What I think is also interesting on the flip side of that, Haji Muhammad Dorji writes about this in her book Sorry Not Sorry, is that it's sort of the antithesis of that, which is that we as women of color, there is an expectation that we will write about that, but we must write about it in terms of our struggle. We can't just choose, you know, and she writes it, and I'm paraphrasing wildly here, but it's the idea that we don't have the privilege in the same way that perhaps a white man can just walk down the street today and I saw a flower and ours must be we must write from the ancestors. We must write from the struggle. Everything must be the struggle, the struggle, the struggle. And I really appreciated when she wrote that, because I thought, absolutely it. Because I wonder if there's almost a voyeurism from those outside of being women of color or people of color that have, we can appreciate the struggle, but we want to do it within the confines of our comfort, in a voyeuristic way. But also that, it's got to be, we have to write our pain and not necessarily our joy.
I think that was my resistance, I think, for a long time. You've touched on it, which is why I felt like I needed to write divorced from context, because I didn't want to be seen in the frame of a woman of color writer. Like, I didn't want to be seen in that little box. So I tried to write stories that felt universal. But of course, in doing that, you're also denying a part of yourself. And I didn't realize then, which I realize now, that you can also change that narrative, that just because there's an expectation on you as a woman of color to write, you know, trauma narratives, doesn't mean you have to, assuage that. Doesn't mean you have to do that. You can write whatever you want. And so my choice now is to be able to write the stories of likeness and comedy and family and heart and inspiration and aspiration and all of those things, and realize that that's as much a part of my narrative as any of the stories that are couched in trauma.
How do you know when a script works? How do you, or do you not? Do you just write what your truth is and however you feel that a story needs to be told, and then you wait to see? Because I remember going to see the Ellen Pakke story. I went to go and watch it at the waterfront, and I sat, even talking about it now makes me quite emotional. I sat in that movie with tears streaming down my face pretty much from the opening scenes to the end. It was beautifully written. It was beautifully shot. I think everyone, Jill and Jared, everyone, just Clint, did an amazing job. But they did an amazing job with the words that you gave them.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. I'm still very touched that people have connected to that film.
It was phenomenal.
Years later. I think for me, knowing when it's right, there's a hum that you find when you're writing in your sort of solo, in your solo time, that's close to something that feels like meditation.
When
you're not forcing it. It's when you're waking up every morning and you're sitting down and you're just allowing things to stream in from your subconscious.
Yep.
I don't know how to explain it.
I know. I call it like my aha moments.
Yes, exactly. And you just feel like you're vibrating on another in another level, and the story is telling itself through you. You're just kind of the vessel. You're allowing the story to happen through you. And then the other moment, of course, is when you hear the actors speaking the words for the first time. So it's always on the first table read. I can tell if I've hit it, if the actors respond in a way that is human, if they feel a connection, if they laugh, if they cry. Like, we had that moment when we did the first table read of Barakat, where The people around the table immediately were laughing, they were crying, and I was like, okay, this works.
Yeah.
So there's those moments of validation that you get throughout a very lonely process, I think.
Yeah, and it is such a lonely process, isn't it? It is that the process of writing is quite isolating, and it is quite lonely. And for me, often those moments of magic that you've just spoken about and that sort of meditation, they happen for me in the wee small hours of the morning in the silence of the night, where everything is quiet. And yes, it does feel a bit lonely, but it's like magic's happening. I love that it is that sort of vibration. It's something happening on another level, to the point where very often, I don't know if you experience this, but I will go back and read things that I've written and I don't remember having written them.
Yes, absolutely. I feel that often. And I mean, your wee hours of the morning, mine is usually like 4:35 a.m. I try to keep a schedule where I wake up at that time and I try to write before the sun comes up. Sure. And I try to finish the majority of my writing before sunrise,
wow,
before the phones start going off,
exactly,
and the, you know, and the cars start outside, and the, you know, it's before the morning.
Yeah.
So I love those early hours, and that's usually where I get the best work done.
Yeah.
Is when there's just like quiet and darkness around me, and I love winter for that too, because the sun doesn't come up till 7:30.
It's beautiful, beautiful times. Let's talk about Barakat.
Sure.
You must be super proud of that. It is a lovely, lovely movie. We had Kino Lee on the other day. Juanita's been with us. It looked like a lot of fun, but it also, it's so authentic. It feels so relatable.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very proud of the reception this film has gotten, and like really thankful that it's been so embraced by the community, because I've always said this film was not for anyone except for the people it was about.
Yeah.
So this film was always just for the community, for Cape Town especially. And I just love that people have really embraced it and made it their own, and it's taken on a life of its own. And it was a fun process. It was from the first to the last day, it was filled with laughter and warmth and everyone bringing their own kind of personal stories to the story that I had written that felt very specific to me. But everyone could relate to it from the first day. And it was that first table reading that really struck the nerve and set the tone for the process.
You won this award, the Best Narrative, at the 23rd Real Sisters of the Diaspora Festival. How do you feel about awards in terms of recognition of you and your work? Do you take them in your stride? Do you bow down to them every evening and thank the gods of creativity? What sort of person are you when it comes to accolades and awards?
I think I'm quite sheepish. I don't like that. I don't like the hype around things. I think it sets you up for failure, because I really try to keep myself as humble and ego-free as possible. And I think sometimes the increasing validation can make you, I mean, as a human, it can make you kind of like lose your head in the clouds a little bit, and that's not what it's about. So I really appreciate when people find truth and connect with my work. That's kind of key for me, when people see something in it that they think is good, or whether it's on a technical level or on a storytelling level. But I don't work with awards in mind. I think a lot of artists will say that. It's never been a thing I've been trying to achieve. There's no kind of like, if I win the X award one day, I will know that I made it. Because, the moment of connecting with one-on-one with people, with my stories, is so much more important than winning an award.
If you're just joining us this morning, our Profiles guest is Amy Jefter, who is playwright, screenwriter, theatre director, storyteller, whose latest movie, Barakat, we've spoken about at length on the show. We've had a few of the stars of that movie join us also in this segment. Amy, what are you currently reading at the moment? What are you watching? What is sparking your interest creatively at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, my tastes are so varied. I love a good trash TV. Like, I'm not above that at all. The Kardashians have ended. I've been watching every single interview, every last episode. I mean, I just need it. Like, I need
so
to also be in the mundane and in the muck sometimes, because, you know, it's relief. And then I'm reading quite a few books that I'm adapting. So I find myself often reading for work right now. I'm reading a few crime novels that I'm kind of considering adapting. Reading a lot of South African work as well. Just finished Mohamed Fuleba and Mia Nadine.
How extraordinary really loved is that? Fantastic.
What a beautiful book. I'm about to start Kaleka Batuma's new collection, Hello, Goodbye, Coco, Come In, which I've been waiting for years.
Oh, we all have. I mean, just on tenterhooks for years,
Exactly. So, sort of new poetry. Ashraf Kadhi's book, By the Fading Light, I've been started with that, and it's kind of swept me also. I read between South African work and sort of trash stuff, and then I'm watching Insecure, catching up on that. Mayor of Easttown is a show that I've really loved.
And then in terms of what's next for you, I mean, you sound like are you a workaholic?
I am trying very hard to wean myself off that habit.
Okay.
So I used to be very kind of like hard driven. And right now I'm finding the most peace in carving out boundaries for myself when it comes to work. So it's about like the discipline of being able to write every day, waking up early, doing my thing. But also when I'm done, I close and I walk away.
When you walk away, do you walk away psychologically too? Or is there something still always ticking in the back of your mind?
Always in the back of your mind. But I think the everything comes together when you are in peace and stillness and doing things you enjoy. So I'm enjoying meditating. I'm enjoying staring out the window. I enjoy playing with my cat, cooking, listening to music, you know, just pottering is where I'm finding a lot of my inspiration these days. Instead of always just driving myself to be working every moment, I like try to switch off my phone at 6 p.m. every night, just kind of carving out space. And I think in this time, it's important for artists to do that. You know, it's been a psychologically tough year to be creative, to still be expected to produce in the midst of what we're going through. And I think any time that artists can sort of preserve themselves and preserve the lifeblood of creativity, you need to do that. Like, you need to put boundaries around yourself, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, it's been an absolute treat to have you on the show. I've really, really enjoyed speaking to you. I'm such a fan of your work. I follow avidly, and it's wonderful to see what you're doing. And I'm fascinated to see what the future holds in terms of you and your work. Amy Jephthah has been our guest on Profiles this morning. Thanks so much for joining us, Amy.